Alright, so we're going to start out looking at our memory verse. We're not going to say it this morning, but I've highlighted a word on there, one single word. And that's going to be our word of focus as we go through today. And that word is that. Looking at this statement here, it's used twice, and specifically on the second one. Therefore, choose life that. It's kind of the so what or the because of the memory verse here. I will apologize for if I maybe seem less enthusiastic today. Voice is kind of going a little bit. So I'm going to ask for lots of participation today to try to keep my voice talking at a minimum. So looking at this, that word life and giving the purpose of the choice that God has put before him, before the people here, is so that they have a chance for them and their offsprings to live. As we go through and look at the law and some of the specifics of the law, some of the craziness of the law, and think about it from that perspective. What is this here for? If you were to append at the end of every law, you shall do this or you shall not do this, that what? What would you answer that with? What is God saying? A lot of these laws don't say that. And we don't want to get into the land of speculation of why did God put that there. But I think looking at the intent and the purpose of the law as a whole, we can answer that question seeing what these things are there for. So I entitled this section Living Under Law because I want to take a little bit of a different perspective of this. I was asking Alicia as we're going through the lesson and trying to figure out, I said, how would you teach the law? If you had to teach Old Testament law, because that's what we've gotten into, is this section of you will do this, you won't do this. What would you do with that? We went around and I asked a couple other people. One of the things that came out was, think about how it would have been to live under this law. If you were an Old Testament Jew and this was given to you, how would you view the law? Would you feel crushed by it? Would you feel oppressed by it? Or would it be something special to you? Would you feel like every day you're trying to memorize the laws so that you wouldn't break them? And would your life change today if you lived under a rule set of laws like this versus what we have now, which is kind of foreshadowing to our last question of what's the difference between the two? But really think about that. What would it be like here to live under these laws today? Verse number 1 in Deuteronomy 19 is something that I labeled it here as the preamble. And looking at this, go ahead and read it. When the Lord your God cuts off the nations whose land the Lord your God has given you, and you dispossess them and dwell in their cities and in their houses. And he goes on and he starts to talk about the cities of refuge that he's going to set up. But when the Lord your God... So I think this right here is the preface, the preamble to what he's going to start saying. These are things that are applicable after the Lord your God has cut off the nations and has given you the land. So we see something that God is going to do here that's going to set up the law. And then the second part is when you, or you, dispossess them and dwell in the cities and their houses. And so we see this joint effort between God and the people. Just establishing further in this, God is driving home this fact of the covenant. These laws are the set rules of the covenant. This is something between me and something between you, and we are going to do this together. Another emphasis in this section here is when the Lord your God, and this says the Lord your God again, we have it repeated twice there, God does not want them to forget who it is that's giving them this land and setting up the covenant. And so the preface behind all of this is coming forward to God. This is all about God and his relationship with his people. As opposed to the oppressive laws that God has imposed to be a stinger on his people. Right? It's like when we look at different things and we look at laws and we see all these laws are here to keep me from having fun. All these laws are here. And you might think about like the speed limit, right? When I was a teenager, the speed limit was just there to keep me from having fun. I did not think about the fact that it was there to keep other people safe, or because maybe other people are bad drivers, and they can't handle that speed, but I could. Right? We view the laws that way, right? It's a selfish way to view the laws, and it also puts a bad relationship between us and the authority that's establishing and enforcing those laws. And so as we look at these laws and we look at that statement, I'm looking at the authority and the power that put these laws and why they were there. Were these put there just because God wanted to oppress a people? Or was there something bigger that he was trying to accomplish? So when we look at the laws, I had set up, I got these slides, I think, backwards. I was going, okay, we've got this whole list of laws. Do we really want to go through and enumerate through every single law and talk about each one? Probably not. You know what? I did this and I duplicated the slide too, so we get it twice up here. But as we look at each law, looking at what does the law say? So that particular law, what does it say? What is the punishment or reward? And then what is the impact of that law? Now, for some of this to make sense, we actually have to look at Leviticus 4 and 5 and chapter 20 and verse 22. Let's start out and read Leviticus 20 and verse 22. Because all of these laws don't actually state a punishment or a reward. Some of them just say, you're going to do this. And as I outline this for myself, I'm looking through and going, I can't answer my own question because it doesn't say it in this text. So going a little bit further, Leviticus 20, 22, this really gets to the impact here. You shall therefore keep all my statutes and all my rules and do them, that the land where I'm bringing you to live may not vomit you out. So God has given them these laws, one purpose, so that the land that they're going into doesn't reject them, or more or less, God doesn't kick them out of this land. These statutes were the things that kept them in the promised land once God had given it to them. And then as we go over and we look at Leviticus 4 and 5, I'm just going to read the beginnings of a couple of these verses. This is 4, I'm going to start in 2, I'm going to be all through these chapters, so just go ahead and listen. Speak to the people of Israel, saying, if anyone sins unintentionally in any of the Lord's commandments about these things not to be done, does any of them, if it is anointed priest who sins, thus bringing guilt on the people, then he shall offer for the sins that he has committed a bull from the herd without blemish to the Lord for a sin offering. If the whole congregation of Israel sins unintentionally, and the thing is hidden from the eyes of the assembly, then they do any one of the things that by the Lord's commandment are not to be done, and they realize their guilt. When the sin which they have committed becomes known, the assembly shall offer a bull from the herd for a sin offering and bring it to the front of the tent of meeting. When a leader sins doing unintentionally one of the things of the commandments of the Lord ought not to be done and realizes his guilt or the sin that he has committed is made known to him, he shall bring as an offering a goat, a male without blemish. And this goes on. Verse 27 of chapter 4, verse 1, 14 and 17 of chapter 5, and then verse 1 of chapter 6. These three chapters really lay out the punishments for sin. There are some punishments that are laid out in the section that we're reading, particularly stoning. There's a lot of stoning, there's a lot of death. We seem to get the big impact ones here in Deuteronomy as God's trying to impress upon them the seriousness of the sin that they've committed. But if we go back, every sin has a punishment or has a consequence for it as they transgress against God. And so keeping that in mind as you look through these, if you do have a chance, go back and read through those chapters in Leviticus to see what the payment was. It was not just that I'm sorry. There was something that was required from the people for the sins that they committed, regardless of the size of the sin. So, did anyone see any of the laws in here that they thought were interesting, impactful, had questions on? I have my list of ones here, but I figure we'll kind of open it up to see what about even one that just seems weird. Allison.
I didn't mark the verse, but it's in 19, I think, where God says offer peace to the town that you're going to take over first, and then if they don't accept it, then you get to go full throttle. But I thought it was not necessarily weird, but interesting.
Yeah, that was one that caught me as well. I think that's in 20, and we're looking at verses 10 to 15. I actually broke them out by sections, so I can jump through a little bit quicker on them. Looking at that one in general, the first thing that actually jumped out at me was, wait, it says offer peace treaty, but aren't they supposed to destroy the entire nation that they go into? And God puts the caveat in there. He actually says further on, in verse 16, not to do that for people that are in the land that they're about to inherit. So this is applicable to people who are far off.
And so we do see that God is still interested in peace and justice. He's not looking for people to just go in and completely wipe out everything. This is your land. And in that area, I want you to destroy everyone and everything. But outside of that, if you decide that you need to go conquer more, first go see if they will be at peace with you. And then if not, go to town. All right? Anything else? There are some ones like that where you read them and the first time and you go, wait, these might conflict with another thing, and then you keep rolling through them and you find that God does provide the correct wording there. Which, thank you as from the lawyer background, Allison. And actually, that brought up something. I was going through. A common thing that we might hear with these laws is that, well, I mean, 613, right? I think that's the kind of the number you hear thrown around, how many laws are in there. And the next line comes out, well, of course, no one can keep all of those laws. Which is kind of a ridiculous statement. How many laws do we have? A lot. And I'm not talking about in the New Testament for us, just in the state of California. if Luke was in here, he'd probably laugh too, right? We have a lot of laws that we are expected to obey, regardless of if you know them or not. As a citizen of the United States, as a member of the state of California, there are laws that we are supposed to live by. And as an Israelite, you were brought up with these laws. You had a schoolmaster or a teacher that was teaching you these laws. They were supposed to be on your doorposts. They were supposed to be everywhere. So really, 613 is not all that many. When we look at that. And the expectation was that they were to know them and they were to abide by them. And if you look back, a lot of the wording in Leviticus talks about if you unintentionally do it, right? So if you have a brain lapse and something happens because you really know that you should have not done this, here's an offering, as opposed to you directly rebel against the law of the Lord.
Other laws. So we have laws for battle. Wes?
I thought it was interesting about the rights of the firstborn, and yet in Israel's history, that's not the case. We see that happening several times, where the one who's not the firstborn gets the greater blessing, and yet it's enshrined here in the law. That's how things are supposed to operate. So that seems like a weird, I don't know, if I were back then, I'd be thinking about, wait a minute, that's not how we got here.
Wait, what about Jacob? Okay, well then, the other elephant room you have to bring up with that is, if a man has two wives, one loved and one unloved, kind of. The only thing I have to say with that one is, I don't think God condones that, doesn't speak out against it, but as New Testament Christians, we don't get to cherry pick back in there and say, look, we can have multiple, don't know why, but he makes a provision there, and I think, again, he's going for this theme of justice in there. Right, the law had stated previously that the firstborn was supposed to inherit the double portion, right, the birthright. And even if you then somehow have two firstborn children qualified by a wife, that's not what it means to be the firstborn. The firstborn is the firstborn son that you have. And so apply the law justly, right, without partiality. Aaron, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, two weird ones that I thought were that they could not cut down the trees that were for food, they needed to let in standing, but all the other trees that were not for food, they needed to cut down. That was one. That would be 20 verses 19 through 20. And then in 22, verse 6 and 7, if you find, this is just so specific. And it has a mother and babies. It just seems like a really specific kind of weird law. Let the mother go, but you can take the young for yourself. Okay, so that's.
Yeah, that one is. I've got nothing on that one. I'm not quite sure. Besides it just not being cruel. That's kind of, it's an odd one in there, and it's in a string of, I would say, maybe a little bit more random laws in there. But back on the one with the trees, so I thought that one was interesting, tying it back to 19:1 when it talks about, these are provisions as you go into the land. He's talking about, when you go to Jericho and you see these huge walls in front of you, the first thing that you're going to want to do is chop down trees to try to make ladders, right, to climb up and scale the walls. there's going to be more cities that they come across that are like this. But wait, when you're destroying the fruit tree, you're destroying the provision and the inheritance that I'm giving you. Right? They're supposed to then go into this land and inhabit houses that aren't theirs and grape vineyards that aren't theirs and eat the fruit that they didn't plant. But that's not going to be possible if you come in here and you mow the whole thing down. And then I like the other part in that where he talks about it's not the trees that are attacking you. Right? It's the people that are in the city. So don't take it out on the trees. Go ahead and destroy the people. Derek?
There's a whole section in chapter 22 where it talks about sexual immorality of various types and rape and even how fathers treat their daughters that are able to be married or not. And it's difficult for I think even for Bible students because our society is so much different nowadays. But it's just, I guess my only commentary on that section is it's already difficult, but it's a tough passage because people who want to rail against God or against the Bible will zero in on sections like this to show how it's so anti-women and who would serve a God like that? A person's not real. And just taking things out of context. And I mean, if someone has that kind of axe to grind, we can't really try and explain the context anyway. It's kind of a fruitless argument. But this is one of those sections that just, it's difficult.
It is, and I think it falls into kind of the same line of when you look at destroy everyone, right? Go into the city. We see that in chapter 20 with the rules of warfare. It's for them to go in and kill the women and children, and you talk about the cruelty of God. But looking at that one, if you actually look, as you read through those, if you think about specifically, I think the one that would come out is that if a woman is raped and she's not betrothed, that they're supposed to just give money, right? And then the man goes, or the woman goes with the man. And at that point, though, if you look at about this and the society in which women who were not pure would have been cast out and kicked out, and it said this is a provision for that woman to be provided for and still a member of the community at that point, as opposed to being ostracized, as we see some of the other ones, which the other ones all, I think, make a little bit more sense to me in the sense of it's really looking at the side of if you are committing this act knowingly, you're going to be purged from Israel, right? You're going to be stoned and taken out. Do not pity, right? Do not let your eye have pity on them. And purge the evil from among you. Those make sense. But looking at this, right, if we're looking at God providing for his people, there's also a case of this is what God thought was best for his people, and so he established this law for them. Any other laws as we go through here? Jamie?
So about the women not wearing man's clothes, man not wearing women's clothes, I thought that was interesting. I think it was pretty reflective today.
He did want a separation for sure with that. I think that's right. He's looking at the separation and might even be looking into the pagan culture there. Right, we see cult prostitution comes up, and it will be, right, your males shall not be cult prostitutes, your females shall not be cult prostitutes, and we want you to wear the correct clothing for your gender. God does not want those lines that I think the society outside of them was going to be blurring, so he sets that up for them as that. And again, these are God's laws coming in, and they very well could be God puts these laws in there, like you will not have mixed fiber clothing, right? There's no polyester blends going on out there. That is set up, and it could just be God saying, I'm going to put this here because I want you to obey me. And that could just be it. At some point, you have to realize the author, this comes back to 19:1 again, we tie back to that. I'm bringing you into this land, and I'm going to tell you what it means to live in this land and to be pleasing to me. And so go ahead and follow this. As ridiculous as it might sound, and that's where I think is really hard. We read these rules and these laws, and sometimes we see they just sound ridiculous. And that's probably because of who we are and where we live. But to these people, they were most likely laws that made a lot of sense. So I want to kind of backtrack now and look at the beginning of chapter 19 with the cities of refuge. So what was the purpose of these cities of refuge? This is going to be chapter 19, verses 2 to 13. What were the cities of refuge? What was their purpose, Grant?
If I can back up for just a second?
Yes.
I think it is important to remember when we look at the Old Testament and the laws that are there that it is not, God didn't necessarily give them the law as his highest ideal of the way things ought to be. Because we do look at, in the New Testament, you know, when Jesus is asked about, you know, can you divorce a woman for any reason, or Moses said we could give a woman a certificate of divorce, and Jesus' answer is that because of the hardness of your hearts, God gave you this law. So it wasn't that God said, this is the way I want things to be. It was, to some extent, throughout the law, there is a recognition of the way things are. And because you are like that, you know, we are like that as human beings, God gave us certain, gave them certain laws. And, you know, since you tend to behave this way, I'm going to give you this law. I wish I could give you this law, but yeah. I'm going to give you this law. We would not necessarily even understand that that was in God's mind until Jesus gives an answer to the question. So we kind of have to assume, it's reasonable, I think, to assume that there are other laws that are also that way, but we're not given that explanation.
Absolutely. I think it's a good part to keep in mind. And I think that really brings up our ability to rationalize the law, right? And we do need to step back a little bit and not try to look at the law and say, I'm going to rationalize everything in here and try to make it okay with me. Because, A, this is at a different time, a different place for different people, and this is the law in the mind of God. And we kind of fall into the same category. At some point, you recognize who God is, and you either believe and obey or you don't, regardless of how intellectual you might think you are or your ability to rationalize that. So thank you very much, Graham. So Cities of Refuge, chapter 19, beginning, what was the purpose of these cities? Mr. Berg.
Well, it was to give a place for someone to go who had accidentally killed someone. He didn't plan it, he didn't think about it, it wasn't premeditated, but some accident happened, and rather than have the deceased person's family just jump on him and want to kill him, he could go somewhere and be protected. And it gives the example of a man and his neighbor or brother going to cut a tree down. Chopping the tree, the axe head came off and hit the guy and killed him. And that's an accident. And so it was a place to go to find refuge. And otherwise, you'd have just people killing each other right and left because somebody accidentally, was killed.
Yeah, thank you for the. They give the example there too, which I think is really good. If someone accidentally kills someone, and this is, or unintentionally, this does not mean you get an argument and I punch you in the face and I kill you. This is, we're doing something unrelated to any hatred between us and something happens and you die. And I think this gives us a little insight. It's not stay in your city and find a place of refuge there. I mean, these are going to be small cities. There's going to be really no place to hide. This is get out and run and go somewhere and find protection somewhere else. So does anyone actually know what cities ended up being the cities of refuge? So there were six of them. As we see here, three when they initially entered the land, and then three more were supposed to be established as well. And this comes from Joshua chapter 20. And we see that Kadesh, Shechem, Hebron, those are going to be on the west side, and Golan, Ramoth-Gilead, and Bezer on the east side. And so we've got six distributed so that the people could actually get to the city that was closest to them and not, well, I accidentally killed someone too far away from the city of refuge and so then I got killed by the Avenger of Blood. And I found something interesting from a 1906 Jewish encyclopedia that kind of gave a little bit more into how much they wanted people to actually get to these cities. This is a corresponding to the care for proper location, these asylum cities were the other ordinances referring to them. The roads leading to them were marked by signposts at the crossroads with the inscription, Refuge. The roads were very broad, smooth, level, in order that the fugitive might not be hindered. And so there were supposed to be big highways that went to these cities so that people could actually get to them and that justice could be served. If we look then a little bit further in Joshua 20, we find a little bit more explanation of what goes on and what this whole process looked like. And so the fugitive takes and he runs, which I think it's interesting. He uses the word fugitive because there has no real crime been committed here. But they take and they run from the scene of the crime to the city. And then at that point, they have to go explain themselves to the elders and say, hey, this is what's going on. And this person is supposed to, is trying to avenge blood on me. And then after the elders hear it, they stand the judgment before the city and they're ruled guilty or not. If they are found innocent, they don't get to go home. They actually stay in that refuge city. And they stay in the refuge city until the high priest of the time dies. Once the high priest at that time dies, they can then go back to their city. And it's, so it's this weird exchange of not only just going there for asylum. You go there for asylum and you stay. And you, if you're not found innocent, you get kicked out and the guy standing outside the gates can have his revenge on you. But other than that, you are then granted asylum. And then there's this magical thing that happens with the high priest. I'm not quite sure why. There was some speculation of it had to do with when the high priest died, that was the lifeblood that was then kind of atoning for the other death, and so then you were free to go. But whatever that is, the provision was, once the high priest at that time had died, you were free to go. So looking at this, what does this tell us about God? This whole city of refuge thing. What does it tell you about God? Wes?
Well, I wasn't thinking about answering that question, but it's interesting to me that what God doesn't say here, which is applying it to our modern system. If this happens, the person who does it is presumed innocent. There needs to be a trial. The avenger can't go take matters into his own hands. Right? He doesn't say that. He says, if this happens, it seems like there's an expectation. If you find yourself in this situation, somebody's coming for you. And it's time to run. Here's where you run. Right? God doesn't say that somebody's going to be mad and they just need to wait until there's a trial. He says, this person needs to go to one of these cities. And then when he gets to the city, then there will be a trial at some point. But the first thing he has to do is he has to get to the city. And apparently if the avenger finds him before then, there's nothing really said here, but I'm guessing that's okay. Or at the very least, God doesn't condemn it here. Mm-hmm.
And I think the when you read the Joshua 20 account, it does seem like there's this expectation that the avenging of blood is going to happen. And so if this is truly an accident, you better get him high horse and you better run. And when we look at this too, and you look at the laws of if you kill someone, what's the penalty? Death. Right? And this is eye for eye, tooth for tooth going on here. And so if you killed someone, the first assumption from mankind, which I think gets back to Grant, you know, while we here in our society like to say that it's innocent until proven guilty, we all actually think guilty, and then hopefully they get proved innocent. And I think in that society, we're looking at the same thing. And so your brother gets killed, and the first thing you're going to do is you're going to go get revenge. And so God then makes this provision for them, like, hey, go run so we can get this, you can get this settled out in one of these cities. So when we look at God with this, Jay, was that a hand?
Yeah, I was going to answer your question.
But, go for it.
I don't want to presume too much because we're not told specifically that God feels this way in this context, but I think I take two things away from it from God's perspective that again, it confirms that God looks at the heart, because if it wasn't intentional, God extends this mercy to you that you should not be killed, you shouldn't lose your life when you intended no evil whatsoever. But the flip side of it is there are still consequences for that life being lost, that it's not great for this person that has to flee because they're leaving their property, they're leaving all their stuff, they're leaving their family if they have one, and they have to just run and go live in this strange place and start over, basically.
Yeah, carelessness is not an excuse for no consequences, right? Because even in that scenario, I mean, if you're working out in construction and your tool malfunctions because of lack of maintenance, right? I mean, you're still liable for the consequence of that. While it was not intentional, you still do have some responsibility. But God also does want justice, right? He looks at the heart and he wants what's right. For me, that was looking at this. God's concerned with justice for both sides, which is really interesting because then we have in my next slide here is looking at this, your eye shall not pity. So we've got these two things back and forth. We have God's saying, don't pity this person. Don't pity these types of individuals. But then this other side of, let's provide refuge and haven for some people. And we see two sides of God that go really both focused towards justice. This is what's right, and this is what's wrong, and this is how you view it. So both of these sections, 19, 13, and 21. So 13 is talking about if you premeditated a murder, right? If you lie in wait for your neighbor because you hate him and you attack him, you shall put him to death. And your eye shall not pity him, and you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from Israel so that it may be well with you. And then 21 is concerning a false witness. If someone comes and presents a false witness, it's the penalty that was supposed to be applied to the person that they were accusing gets applied to them, right? And so this is a little bit of motivation not to go perjure yourself. And so he says both of this, do not pity this person. Why would you pity these people? Why does he say this? Does God want them to be callous to killing? Okay.
I think you can see even today that our tendency sometimes is to pity. So, that's why people don't want the death penalty and other kinds of things where, we want lower penalties for certain crimes. And God is saying, when you leave that element in there, it can cause, others to be encouraged to sin. And so I want you to get rid of it so that it may go well with you. But at the same time, he says in verse 20, that the rest shall hear and fear. So other people will see this example and know that, they can't get away with it either.
Aaron?
I think it also might kind of speak to partiality, that, even someone and now there's several witnesses against them for something that they've done, and you maybe don't want to believe it or, whatever, you can't be partial, your eye can't be against us.
Tim?
I was just going to say, to add on to that, I think we bring our own judgment and our sense of right and wrong into it. We're straying from what God has told us to do. If this happens, this is the consequence. And the moment we start to feel sorry and make excuses or I can see why, then all of a sudden we're going to change what that penalty is or what the consequence is. And as we all know, once you get that one degree off, the longer you do that, the farther you get away from where you were pointing originally. And I think this is just, don't pity. This was brought upon them. Everyone knows the punishment. Do as I have commanded you to do.
Yeah, so on that line, God's view and seriousness of sin, when he looks at this and he says, this is sin and they have committed sin and this is the punishment for sin. So do not pity them for the choices that they've made in transgression my law. Then the opposite side also then with the refuge. Don't punish them for something that they didn't do. God's concern here with justice and his seriousness for keeping his law and not taking your feelings, whether it be the revenge or the pity, going against what God has set as the standard. Allison?
I was thinking along the lines of Aaron and a section that we skipped, I'm sure in the interest of time, but in chapter 13, in verses 6 through 11, it says, if your brother or your son or your daughter or the wife you embrace or your friend who is as your own soul entices you to idolatry, you're supposed to be the first to grab the stone and throw it. That's super hard. it was very shocking to me to read that. I don't remember ever having read that before. And it's like, I think it's God saying, he knows that it's easy to say, oh, we should do this. And then it's your daughter, and you're like, but maybe this time we could just tell her don't do that again, or whatever. No. That's not what it says. It says actually you're supposed to be the one to first pick up and throw the first stone against her as an idolater. And I think it ties in with that. Don't pity. Don't let your personal feelings come into the fact that God says, get the leaven out.
Okay.
kind of brings, if you jump forward then to Jesus' teaching, right? He talks about when you bring not peace but a sword, and he talks about then dividing the families, right? It's really dividing on what family are you part of. I think it's the same delineation here. They've chosen to leave the community here of Israel and covenant with God, and so at that point they are cut off. We see this with in this section with rebellious children. Your child is rebellious, and you go up to the elders and you say, my child is rebellious. They say, here's a stone. Go take him outside and stone him. Right? Remove, purge the evil from among you. And the seriousness that God has of this community of his people. So this kind of then wraps up back to where we started with the imagine yourself living under this. I think it's the second question in our lesson is when someone says that they believe we are supposed to keep the Old Testament, how does knowing these laws help answer that claim that we should or shouldn't? I also provided my own interpretation, another view of this, of how does knowing the entire law keep us from wanting to cherry pick laws from it? So essentially, why don't we just go through these sections? Allison.
Well, the second question is, if you're going to, I mean, they're related, of course, but if you're going to, if you say, oh, yeah, this verse from the Old Testament, this is, I know this applies to us today, you got to take the whole thing. It's all or nothing. So are you going to be offering those animal sacrifices? I mean, this is something I wonder about with people who are Jewish today. How do they explain this away? I don't know the answer. But they say they're Jews and they're following the Old Testament, but they ain't doing any of this. So I don't exactly get it.
Right, and I think our section with next week or next lesson is divorce. Right, and we want to go and we want to look at that as a binding law. We can look at it as something of the character of God and what He has expected of His people. But when it comes to something we would bind as law, right, that's not going to be applicable. Some things are easier than others to go and jump into. Is there anything about the things that we have read, specifics about even individual laws, that would answer the question: does this apply to us or not? Wes.
I think today we have a really hard time keeping the first part of chapter 21 about the elders. Because it talks about the elders of the town and the measuring distance. And there's Levites and there's priests and there's certain things said and there's heifer that's slain. And how would you do that today? Because this is not an individual thing like, I'm going to choose to keep this. This is communal. This is corporate. So they have to figure out, okay, we found somebody in the field that's been murdered. Which town is it closest to? And then there's certain things that have to happen. So I don't know how you would do that today.
Right, so then you bring up, and this is one of the things that we see in the law, that there are specifics that are based on geography, location, time, and people. These were given for the Israelites living in the promised land, applicable to them, which then makes sections of, say, Romans and Ephesians make sense when it talks about the Gentiles who were excluded. They had no hope. They were not Israel living in the promised land with the law of God, which was applicable to them. Right? That was salvation at that point, right then. And so we look and we see through these things very specific, like just the refuge cities. What do we do with that now? How does that apply? How does that go? I guess, depending on which way you go, right, what side of the Jordan we're on, how far should we run? I mean, these are specific laws that have specific binding things that cannot be implemented. The other thing that has been brought up a couple times is that this was a theocracy under God. This was their government. This was their culture. This was a physical country with physical laws and a physical people. And these were those binding laws. We are not part of that. And our relationship with God is also not defined in the same way. Aaron?
Several of these talk about, you know, when you go to war against your enemies. And I was just going to say, we are not a nation who would do that. And I think what you said about, you know, that they were for God's specific people of that time is that, you know, 10 times between 19 and 23, 10 times he says, in the land that the Lord your God is giving you, or something to that effect. I mean, he says it 10 times over and over and over. And most of it is saying so that you don't defile the land that the Lord your God has given you. And so obviously that is very specific to a promised land.
Right. Right, and that does not apply to us today. As much as we might talk about one nation under God, this is not the promised land. This is not that land that God has specified under these laws. So as we look and we further go on with this, comparing the Old Testament and the New Testament, and we look at these laws, do we just throw away this whole concept and say that the New Testament has no laws? Because we do hear that we're not under law, we're under grace. But what's the style difference? What is the difference in the implementation of the Old Testament versus the New Testament? This was kind of goes to the heart of question number three. Aaron?
The New Testament covenant is a spiritual covenant, not so much a physical covenant. I mean, it was spiritual in the Old Testament as well. However, it was very physical too. You're going to be a nation. Going to have land. You're going to, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, a lot of the laws in the New Testament are heart issues because there's
scripture. I'm going to run a little bit with what you said just to play advocate on it and say, okay, so if the one was spiritual and the one was physical, does that give me license to do what I want? There's no physical laws in the New Testament.
I mean, if your heart is going to make you act in a certain way, your actions are going to be the fruit of your heart. So I don't see how you could do something that would be contrary to God's law, but in your heart, be obeying God.
We see the opposite in the Old Testament, right? Where they do the thing that God has told them to, but their heart is not there. Right? Which is not what he desired. We saw earlier in Deuteronomy, he desired the heart and the obedience from the heart. That wasn't directed right back at you, Aaron. And this, okay. This was more looking at, when we start talking about this, and we start talking about not being bound under the Old Testament law, and that we live under grace, the first thing that happens then is all the rules go out. Right? And there's no expectation, which I think is the biggest insult to God. There is an expectation for his people. But when we look at the transition from the Old Testament to the New Testament, we see him transfer from these precepts, these laws that say you must do this, you must not do that, to these statements that say these type of people will be in the kingdom of heaven. These type of people, these things are the fruits of the Spirit. These are the evidence, right? By love, you shall know this. We start looking at, as Aaron said, the heart, and from the heart then come these actions. So we know that people who are unjust, who do not love, they don't inherit the kingdom of God, and so they are violating and breaking God's laws. And we see that we do still have sin, and sin being the transgression of law means that there is still some expectation or righteousness that is from God. So as we look at that, then look at we live under God's righteous law now, in which we are free to serve him, to show the love and gratitude we have. And so there is still an expectation for us, just not those same Old Testament ones that he has. So we're out of time. Thank you. And we'll there's a couple other comments. We'll pick them up on Sunday and then move into our next lesson for chapter 24. Thank you.